Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects. I'm glad that you're able to sit in. I think we have a program worth your attention today. Entering the age of fellowcraft, magician, traveler, builder. It's a good commentary. It made me sit back and as I was writing it and rethink. We're living in interesting times. I'm just aware of the complications, the distress happening in parts of the world where we seem to be, mankind seems to be needing to deal with a constant threat to democracies. If only it was as simple as politics, but it's something deeper. I've selected the poetry of Alphonse Lamartine. His writings have a personal effect. I think you'll enjoy it. We'll get into that in due time. We certainly are in a bunch who enjoy looking in the mirror. It's a wonder that most lodges don't have their walls lined with mirrors, because it is what we do. And primping and posturing and preening. And seeing just how magnificent, when we look there, just how magnificent the reflection is. Only boys, people, we've been doing this for a long time. We've been doing this for too long. If ever there was a time to be reflecting in the pool and being fascinated by what you see, Freemasons have been doing that for a long time. Oh, what to do. Interesting. I find it very interesting. Dissecting the language that we use beyond just being erudite, it's It's a shift in thinking. The difference between blame and responsibility. It's like looking at that whole question of self-sacrifice. When an individual, you or me, makes a sacrifice, it doesn't mean it's voluntary. It doesn't mean that everybody is going to make the same sacrifice. I happen to live in a country where people are quite ready to stand up and lend a helping hand. I'm fortunate that way. We think in terms of that collective, there's a pride, and there's a growing nationalism, and yes, that can be fraught, but this is the healthy side of it, and because we're able to examine some painful realities about where I live, where I am. Painful, and it's part of history, and we need to be able to reconcile somehow. And maybe we look to the way Germany has shown courage within itself. Not for the outside to suggest this, but there are some things that need to be done that can only be done from within. And I mean that most sincerely. That shift, the individual responsibility, the individual sacrifice is going to be for the benefit of all. And I do see and I do recognize that there are people, and you've spoken to them, and I'm sure I have, that think it's there's no reason for people to sacrifice. It's like giving a pint of blood. Why would you do that? I know there's some faith groups that would never. There's some cultural groups that would never. And yet, making that kind of a sacrifice, is it to save life, to give something back? Quite remarkable. Everyone benefits. Even the idea, everyone benefits. But it does not suggest that even the person that it suggests that even the person who isn't interested at all in making sacrifice will benefit. That turn of thought is where Masonry is most at home. We're engaged in a different way. It's not that we're exposed to Aristotelian ethics and, you know, values and principles and the thinking of the imagination of Kant and Spinoza. It's not that we're exposed to this for nothing. It's to allow us to, at some point, if we're capable intellectually, and in terms of character, to make that sacrifice without having that need for profit in some way. That need for praise. Ego. I only do something for others that I don't know because it strokes my ego. Well, I don't know at the finer doing things. If you've had that, try this, I suggest. Those acts of random Masonic kindness that I'm talking about, randomness, it's like the, this is covered in scripture. All the major scriptures, that golden rule. We have a, try it and feel the experience for yourself. Feel the experience for yourself. And then to talk with me about altruism. Is there something quite selfless about those types of acts? Well, from the outside, I don't think it's feasible to address that in its fullness. Do it, but reserve that doubt, reserve that judgment, and examine the effect on you. See what it does. what it, how it affects me when that's happened is something I'm not going to necessarily share with you, but I'm suggesting here that it's worthwhile. It is worthwhile. We know now, in terms of brain function, that the human, here we go, brain and mind, mind and body, where is that philosopher, right? we know that that something happens to us emotionally when we're providing, let's use the word service, for others. Something happens. I didn't say subservience, did I? Pack that ego away there, mister. You've been looking in the pool too long, or somebody's taken you at an early age and said, look at how beautiful you are. Well, they misled you. They had their own selfish reasons for that. This is a bit of a reality check. Doing something selflessly is a carefully, how to do that is a carefully guarded secret. So I want to put a pin in this. The question's been brought to me many, many times, and I listen to the older, forceful members as if ordering me that to follow the way, their way. Their ideas. I never really subscribed to that. It hasn't helped. We have thousands of opinion pieces that outline in careful detail, and some that would make a poet weep, the way. The science is there. What we haven't, we're a little bit soft on is how. We'll tell you, we're there to tell you what to do. Here's the ethics. The way that we word how, the way that we handle that whole process is a bit obscure. It's we shy away from that authoritarianism. You know, we're not going to be divisive here. This is simply it's like putting walking into a pastry shop. You don't walk in. Don't walk in if you don't want to be there. And certainly don't walk in if all you can do is trigger your own inadequacy and start talking about how bad this is for your health. Like, leave. Just go over there. No, this is a conversation for adults here. You and I know that the how of Masonic principle has something to do with us. The change that we need, you know, doing things the same, you've heard this, you know, time and again, I'm sorry. The doing things the same and expecting change, well, that's not just a cliche anymore. That's tired. I find it profoundly interesting that when I walk around in Masonic circles, there's so much pretending, so much acting going on. So much acting and not as much being as I would expect. As you would expect, as one would expect. This, the whole, the slogan is, almost undigestible. It's why it lasted. It's not that it has some permanent resonance. It's not that it's something that can't be digested. It's like the almond pit to eat. The changes are within. It's not change for the sake of change. Our opportunity to sit together and share these intimate thoughts has been organized, curated. We have a study guide. Thank you. You know, after you walk away from university, realizing and reading something. Let's say you're reading classical literature and realizing there's a whole study group with a professor willing to take you through the analysis of a bit of literature. And here when you're doing it on your own, I think there's a realization that being a student with a mentor, with a good teacher, not a lout, you know, not those preachy kinds that are just boring as hell, the stimulating kind, they get it. It's invaluable. Freemasonry, it's out there. But it's not just flopping around, that looseness. And yes, our process is lined with mirrors on each side, and nobody can stop you from stopping. Nobody can stop you from being transfixed by the reflection. Why? How would we do that? Just push you along? Nothing to see here. Keep moving? No. You have to learn the lesson in order to move along. And if you don't, okay. But the crowd of people that have chosen to settle away from their the reality of what they know, this isn't like we're making this up, and my goodness, this is certainly not that. Saying words that somebody doesn't already know. We already know this. There is no wiggle room here. We already know this. No, we can get up on our hind legs and in all of our glory and with exercising this feeble authority. And I say feeble because compared to the authenticity of Masonic principle, the use of authority is feeble. Unless you're prone to that notion that this intellectual text is somehow powerful. I don't know that. Neither do you. The change isn't out there, and it isn't by authority or refused by bureaucrats. That has nothing at all to do with it. There is absolutely nothing standing in the way of your growth. Yes, you might feel, I grant it, the ministrations of grand lodges can be, I don't know, off-putting, or because, you know, the messaging has been the wine has been watered too much and too often. Like I'm sort of fascinated with that phrase the last couple of months. But we've done it. We've visited that well too many times. It's a couple hundred years here. You think we're recreating, we're making sequels about something magnificent. So we're sitting in a studio when we're looking at the Mona Lisa, and we've all been trying to learn and replicate, duplicate that over and over and over. And then the people that were in the Louvre went back home with their work and showed it to me and said, here, do the same. Try to capture that. Well, how many generations has it been before, you know, the Mona Lisa turns into something that's just sort of a lump? And then to hear the Lord of the Flies crowd say, oh, you know, put away those brushes, use a spray can. What are you looking for that detail for? You're not going to capture that angst. You're not going to capture the emotion. Come on, just, you don't have to. You don't have to. Just show up, make your X on the canvas. That's enough. We'll be happy. And by the way, you're brilliant with it. We know and we all understand. You come to our halls expecting elegance. You expect the filigree of idea. You come expecting and not knowing the challenge. When we shifted our thinking and realized that this was that crowd sharing within masonry would give us some advantages and opened up the administration to middle class thinking. The democratization of masonry began. That hasn't stopped. So here, you sit with me with your a bit of libation at hand, something that you enjoy. Hopefully you've begun to create, or you have created, an environment that's comfortable and allows you to focus, gives you a sense of control, even though we know better. The conversation is ruthlessly about what's going on inside. Ruthlessly. Make those connections. The finding the way, it's there, and you and I know it. It's acknowledging it within ourselves. Oh, no. You're not, you and I aren't here to rehabilitate people. And if you're making progress, don't expect that the lodge is going to be on bended knee or bending over and pulling that forelock. Certainly not. And if I might add, you should expect to feel that within your heart and within your mind, and experience constant pressure. Constant. Somebody, and often a crowd, will be there telling you how wrong you are, how mistaken you are, how you must be much more prepared to accept an external reality of Masonic thinking. Accept an authority, obedience and compliance. Only first, we begin with intellectual clarity. Nonsense? Yeah, absolutely. The poet that I've chosen today is for a couple of reasons. It'll go over this during that part of the show. It's a French poet. If you ask me about my core beliefs, I am a Republican, not of a party, but of the spirit. I like the notion that people have their responsibility, like Freemasonry appeals to me for that reason, and that as ridiculous as it seems, good men don't need somebody telling them the difference between right and wrong. Heresy in the 21st century, eh? In my mind, I come from a part of the world and part of my experience where contracts were negotiated on a handshake. Oh, the cynics are salivating right about now. But we need that kind of protection. The honorable people aren't foolish. Things have changed. Now we're looking at building a global community. Stepping up Freemasonry, and look at the immediately as we step onto that audience, what do we see? A lot of hand flapping, you know, jazz hands all over the place. What do we do? Look over there. stiff upper lip. What we all know is rhetoric. That's not why people are interested in putting you on stage and listening. What they're looking for is this. What they're looking for is this. The poet today, Lamartine, once said this, and I've had this with me for a very, very long time. Hey, music is the literature of the heart. It commences where speech ends. The time when the ideas flow, and they reach a point where the imagination needs to come into play and fill in the mind. I'm inclined, perhaps by an optimistic spirit that was nurtured when I was a little boy, to think in terms of solutions. The bigger the problem, the more we need to be able to bring observers to the forefront. Even as we're rashly jumping in to do something, because, you know, there are times when we just feel, without sorting out the merit of what we're doing, the reason we're doing it, we have to do something. If you've ever been faced with those life and death situations, you'll know. And I'm not talking here about people who are feeling guilty because they've used their authority inappropriately. No, I've had those conversations with too many of you, so we're not going to go there. This is an optimism that I think is a reality. You can say what we will about the chaos around it. Much, I think, of that is perception and that plays on us, and we're quite willing victims. And I think it's almost self-abuse. We line up and take our dose, and allow the media to have that effect. And don't be so foolish to think that media doesn't have its effect. No, of course it does. Entering the age of fellowcraft, you know, you feel that it's aspirational? Magician, traveler, builder. It is an old ploy, widely known. Work from facts and draw conclusions. Work from conclusions and find facts to substantiate. Given the hundreds and thousands of well-preserved opinion pieces available to us, doing the latter is making otherwise mediocre scholarship appear more substantive than it is. Work from conclusions and find facts to substantiate. For the discerning mind, we need rules of engagement to help reduce the chaos. Like when I listen in awe to students of the cabal, I lose track of the content so consistently, not because it is boring, but because of the zeal with which it is delivered. It imparts the off-putting fire and brimstone lectures of the piety that failed to impart the beauty of faith. As coincidence would have it, I had a copy of the Ars Quattro Coronati annual nearby, volume 66 from 1954, and turned to a piece on King Solomon by Brother Gerard Brett, in which he cites some interesting findings. The root of our Hiramic legend may never be found. Within the Solomon tradition are three strands and have a bearing on our legends: the magician, the wise man, and the builder. He references First Kings 29-34, Wisdom 17-22. I leave that for you should you be in need of reassurance. What caught my attention was the notion of magician and our apparent preoccupation with the builder. And more so, it reinforced the need to be well studied in order to put Masonic content into a context that you will use or ignore as you please, to draw meaning and relevance from this order to your life. I can perfectly understand my friend Joseph, who experienced the energy of spirituality practiced in his lodge over there in his native land, and here gasped where he could not find it being practiced. Having said that, I am of a mind that many practices are evolving, breaking out around the surface of the earth in a study of arts and sciences, where metaphysics bursts from logic. By holding a point of view, we then reveal ethics and presence of mind. I have the feeling this is the way of masonry. It's the way that it's been for a long, long time, because that kind of conversation, you know, 17th century, Renaissance happening, 16th century, Renaissance happening, the ideas turned heads. Didn't have to. And at the time, there would be people just plodding along, say, oh, that's nonsense. You know, I need to, and my brain is full of enough ideas. I don't need any more. Like the people that don't want to go to hospital because they think it's all bad news. Don't take your temperature because it might be a sign of a symptom. No, every so often. We can't stop, you know, even when there's eclipse, we can't stop some knuckleheads from looking up at the sun. Better, I guess, that we kneel and experience the awe of it all. Thank you. Lenny Tristano, for those of you who are interested. This is a 1955 recording of You Go to My Head. I know, it's a bit cheesy after a commentary like that to put in that piece. I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it. If greatness of purpose, smallness of means, and astonishing results are the three criteria of a human genius, who could compare any great man in history with Muhammad? Who would dare? Sometimes when one person is missing, the whole world seems depopulated. Limited in his nature, infinite in his desires, man is a fallen god who remembers the heavens. Brutality to an animal is cruelty to mankind. It is only the difference in the victim. Time is a great ocean, which, like the other ocean, overflows with our remains. We cannot weep over everything. Every man has his own sorrows, every century its own pity, and this is enough. Silence. The applause of real and durable impressions was broken by no one. Each rejected in the other the thoughts he felt to be the same as his own. Each respected. These are the things that have been captured, quotes by Alphonse de Lamartine. Interesting man. A poet, eh? A source of truth, eh? And his father, an aristocrat, was imprisoned during the last stages of the French Revolution. But his dad escaped the guillotine. Alphonse was educated at the college and at Belley, and it was kept by the Jesuits. So we have a sense of the nature of the explorations that were going on. And he wanted to enter the army or the diplomatic corps, but because France was ruled by Napoleon, his faithful parents, royalists, regarded him, Napoleon, as the usurper, and he wouldn't allow their boy to serve. So he remained idle until the Bourbon monarchy was restored in 1814, and then he served in Louis the Eighth's bodyguard. Not necessarily a slacker. The following year, Napoleon returned from exile and attempted to rebuild. And Lamartine emigrated to Switzerland. And after Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo and the second Bourbon Restoration, the poet abandoned his military profession. He began writing. He wrote some tragedies in verse, but his health had gone from good to bad. And he went to be rejuvenated in a spa. And there he met another desperately ill person, Julie Charles. And early in 1812, he was just smitten. She was a young working girl, Antoniella. And in 1815, he learned of her death. And later he was to recast her as Griselda in his prose anecdote of that name. And now he became passionately attached to Charles, who, because of her vast connections in Paris, was able to help him find a position. And after her death in December 1817, Lamartine, who had already dedicated many strophes to her, devoted new verses to her memory. Interesting fellow. His poetry developed, as did everything in his life, by degrees. And with no marked departures from the past, rarely have life and art been so closely intertwined. Now, when I found this analysis of Alphonse de Lamartine, I was just captured to say that about a person. All his passions became the stuff of his art, to be woven into complex patterns of alliteration and assonance. So perhaps he created only a handful of enduring works, but few poets can claim to have done more. So we're going to put this out there for you, the judge and jury, the poets in the audience, the poets, every one of you who have ever sat down and enjoyed a piece of music, good poets, oh, call it something else to soothe your chauvinistic nature, the way you've been brought up, the limits of your own resolve, but take this for what it's worth. And consider whether it reveals any truth, a truth. Thus ever driven onward to new shores, borne constantly away, can we never, in the ocean of the ages, drop anchor for a day? Oh, this beautiful lake, the year has hardly flown, yet here I am, beside these so beloved waves of hers, here, but alone. Waves, you crashed against these rocks for her, white, blazing, beat your heads against the wind, but also caressed her lovely feet. One night, do you remember? We lay here and felt the rhythmic swish of oarsmen slicing through your pelt. That night was so enchanted. I swear to you, I heard accents never known on earth as she let fall these words. Oh, time, stop your flight. Hours don't run by. Allow us to savor this delight, the best of life's brief day. So many unhappy ones implore you. Run, run, run for them. Take to the cares which eat them up. But leave us, please, in peccem. It's fruitless to complain, but these moments aren't enough. I beg shy night to linger, but look, bold dawn scares her off. So let us love then, let us love. Time cannot be caged. Make haste, we'll strut for our tiny hour, and then must quit the stage. Jealous time, why do you rob with such frank eagerness our days of joy, but dawdle when you see us in distress? Why is it that we live and love, but leave no trace? Why give us these raptures which you then efface. Eternity, nothingness, the past, such somber chasms. Where do you hide our human fire, our passion-prompted spasms? Lake, tall rocks, oh, deep and secret woods. Noemi, won't you keep us at least some memory? We live on in your calm, sweet lake, your storms, your laughing shores, your gloomy pine trees, craggy rocks through which the water roars. It's in the summer wind we live, which ruffles as it kisses, and in the single thoughtful star which reflects and reminisces. The rose which droops, the oak and ivy glove to the fragrance of the forest. These will tell the world they loved. What truth could somebody possibly find in something like that? Oh, this isn't a time to push away from your imagination. That's what the poets are trying to help us with. They tell us that the imagination contains truths. Remember, this part of our history that we're going over has to do with some mythological history that we clung to for quite a long time. This is in the development of masonry, the history of masonry. The part that we're dealing with today has to do with private assemblies in 18th century British Freemasons, armed with a mythic history, attempting to recreate the order and civility and harmony they imagined embodied in the post-1689 Augustan style. The history, just to encapsulate it was that within the constitutions codified in 1723 by the London Lodges, they had organized themselves into the Grand Lodge of London, and the preface to that work explicitly linked the development of Freemasonry to the political history of England. Here's just something to keep in mind. Prince Edwin is said the son of the 10th century Saxon King Athelstan, assembled the first general meeting of all the Masons. No evidence, no. That assembly did frame the Constitution and charges of an English lodge, made a law to preserve and observe the same in all time coming. It was not uncommon. Even the Christian Bible it follows that logic, that the notion that the greater the age of the idea of the body, the more authentic it could be. So going further back, using arcane language, a language that I know in the King James, that was not spoken. I don't know Aramaic. I don't. But it had to be sanitized in a way, modified so that it would speak to people. People could recognize it. In their private assemblies, 18th century British Freemasons, armed with this mythic history, could attempt to recreate the order, civility, and harmony they imagined embodied in the post-1689 style. The constitutions for the Freemasons gradually became identified with the practices of ancient constitutional government enshrined in the Revolution Settlement of 1689. And once identified with originally British practices of government, the lodges, when exported or even on native ground, could become, in effect, private exercises in self-government. If the mores and governing practices of the lodge were then taken to have meaning, to be exemplary for the larger civil polity, then also they could have seriously divisive implications, if not even intentions, particularly in those European states governed by absolute monarchies. Remember this notion, self-government. And then think back, think of the connection with your Grand Lodge. The civil society of the lodge. And then think of Thomas More's work, before I go on. Think about the notion of utopia and what it requires to live in a utopian state, not something I want ever to experience. The civil society of the lodges also differed from the salons and academies of the period, many of them no less socially exclusive, in articulating a hostility toward the world. To hold it at a distance, Masonic rhetoric defined the non-Masonic as the profane. The term Cowan, used in the British lodges to denote an outsider, quickly evolved into stranger, and then on the continent into le profane. With the new word came new meaning. The profane were not just different, but morally and often intellectually inferior. This Masonic sense of uniqueness was further reinforced by rituals of initiation and advancement in the Masonic mysteries that bonded all brothers, supposedly for life. Added to this ritual bond were significant dues and a commitment to charity for brothers or their families fallen on hard times. In the Masonic experience of the 18th century, we have more than simply another example of the new sociability of literate and urbane elites. For its devotees, Freemasonry became the cult of enlightenment, presenting a set of distinctive values by which men and some women might now organize their lives. What became cultic for some educated and idealistic men by the middle of the 18th century had roots probably no less intensely felt in the experience of working men. Got your attention, eh? We'll leave it there. And we will come back. Oh, you can rest assured. This debate, think about it. It has its roots to think that you can have one without the other. Can you have the designer without the builder? Well, you know. And then to sit back, I think it reflects on each person to determine what the essentials were, who is to blame. Huh? All of these ideas are processes that have to do with the human condition, back and forth, dialogue. Whether I agree or not with the notion that the independent, the self-government, was within the lodge, not within the bureaucracy. The larger bureaucracies of Grand Lodges is irrelevant to you. But this I do know. The optics of recognition are changing. Looking into being fascinated by the reflection in the mirror, it's not worked, because the people that have been doing it so readily have been doing it for so long, even they are now walking away with their heads bowed. They realize it's meaningless. And that's where the optimism comes forward. Eh? Meaningless? Huh. Our philosophy is not meaningless. It's just, if you've been standing there facing the mirror for so long, let me remind you, we're headed in a direction. Just turn your head very slightly. You'll see the path and take the next step. Take the next step, little Narcissus. I look forward to having you sit in and join this continuous process, the talk, the ideas, the sharing. I don't have all the words, so I add music to it. So it continues the thought with you, within you. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and realize it's not that change is coming or change is going. It's always. This is a little Freddie Hubbard for you. See you soon.